Today is April the 28th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, that's a Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank at pcradioshow.org. The United States Supreme Court puts a stop to the Federal Trade Commission extracting big bucks from crooks to refund victims. The U.S. government consumer watchdog cannot force scammers to return the money they cheated out of their victims. The Supreme Court declared unanimously this week, which means a 9-0 vote. All nine justices on America's highest court ruling was against the Federal Trade Commission on Thursday, and instead sided with payday loan firm AMG Capital Management. The business's founder, Scott Tucker, was criminally convicted in 2017 of setting illegal interest rates to extract hundreds of millions of dollars from people. Specifically, Tucker and his lawyer were convicted of racketeering, wire fraud, and money laundering after setting up chains of payday lending companies charging up to 1,000% interest on loans. Tucker is serving a 16-year, 8-month prison sentence with his lawyer, Tim Mirror, getting 8 years. The FTC also went to court to extract at least $500 million from the business and in 2018 started sending the money to the crooks' victims as refund checks. But AMG sued all the way to the highest court in the land to stop the payback and has now won. The Supreme Court said they were not convinced that the FTC had the power to extract payments for citizens, and Congress would have to authorize that. In AMG Capital, the Supreme Court ruling in favor of the scam artists and dishonest corporations, leaving average Americans to pay for illegal behavior. The Federal Trade Commission's acting chairwoman, Rebecca Kelly Slaughter, said in a statement, "With this ruling, the court has deprived the FTC of the strongest tool we had to help consumers when they need it most. We urge Congress to act swiftly to restore and strengthen the powers of the agency so we can make wrong consumers whole." The letter of the law. The regulator's position is that under Section 13B of the Federal Trade Commission Act, if it had reason to believe that any party is violating or is about to violate laws that the watchdog enforces, it could seek injunctive relief and to end any unfair or deceptive trade practices and impose monetary penalties to remedy past violations. However, the Supreme Court disagreed that this allows the FTC to extract, via the courts, refunds from scam artists. The question presented is whether this statutory language authorizes the commission to seek and a court to award equitable monetary relief such as restitution or disgorgement. Justice Breyer declared, "We conclude it does not." The ruling effectively derails the FTC's effort to help victims get their money back. Over the past 40 years, Slaughter continued, the commission has relied on Section 13B of the Federal Trade Commission Act to secure billions of dollars in relief for consumers in a wide variety of cases, including telemarketing fraud, anti-competitive pharmaceutical practices, data security and privacy, scams that target seniors and veterans, and deceptive business practices, among many others. More recently, in the wake of the pandemic, the Federal Trade Commission had used Section 13B to take action against entities operating COVID-related scams. Section 13B enforcement cases have resulted in the return of billions of dollars to consumers targeted by a wide variety of illegal scams and anti-competitive practices, including $11.2 billion in refunds to consumers during just the past 5 years. It should be noted that the FTC can still fight for civil penalties against wrongdoers. However, that money goes to the U.S. government, But the maximum amount it can receive in those instances is a very small amount compared to the millions it used to get back as refunds for folks. Companies are more likely to get away with a slap on the wrist unless the Department of Justice steps in with criminal charges against swindlers. The Federal Trade Commission said it will lobby to reform Section 13B to restore its previous powers, which it didn't really have in the first place. Slaughter is expected to testify before the Consumer Protection Subcommittee of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce next week. Let's hope they succeed. This is ridiculous. In other words, if you get cheated, you can't get a refund because the law doesn't specify it. But neither does the law say you can't refund the money back to the consumers. Just logical thinking, that's all. The chip shortage. The cause of the chip shortage and the blame game. Chip makers are struggling to keep up with the demand. These companies and products are feeling the crunch. There is another round of production cuts in everything from large automobiles to small video game consoles. Over the last several months, semiconductor makers have been unable to keep up. The reasons behind the supply-demand imbalance are unclear and have resulted in a lot of finger-pointing. The car companies like to keep making cars, and consumer electronics companies want to keep producing gadgets. Slowdowns are a cause for concern, especially with an unclear end in sight. Why is there a semiconductor shortage? That's a fair enough question to ask, but there is no general agreement on the answer. Largely, the coronavirus pandemic is responsible, and in the earliest weeks and months, semiconductor makers face factory shutdowns and business restrictions. At the same time, their customers were closing showrooms and factories of their own, representing a major drop in chip demand. Take, for instance, the automotive industry. With stay-at-home orders and a rise in work from home, consumers were simply not driving as much. This meant that standard demand for cars dropped, and Ford and General Motors were halting factory production. They did not need as many chips because they were not making as many cars. However, auto demand hit a resurgence, as did demand for consumer electronics. This is where the blame game comes in. Chip makers blame automakers for keeping the inventories low and not preparing enough in advance. Automakers think chip makers are favoring their consumer electronics clientele. Some say bored video gamers took supply away from leading automobile firms. So what happens moving forward? Adding capacity to chip plants cannot happen overnight. Most companies are already running at full capacity. Building a new one would cost billions of dollars. For now, then, the question is about how long it would take for the imbalance to right itself, and which companies will suffer most in the meantime. With that in mind, auto stocks are hit the hardest in light of the chip shortage. According to one report, the production of 946,000 vehicles across the industry is at stake just this year thanks to the semiconductor frenzy. General Motors added its production losses to that tally, announcing that it would cut or reduce production at four plants in Kansas, Canada, Mexico, and South Korea. Although General Motors has not shared the specifics, the production cuts will impact the Chevrolet, Malibu, Cadillac, XT4, Chevy Equinox, Chevy Trax, GMC Terrain SUVs, and the Buick Encore. General Motors is joined by Volkswagen, Ford, Subaru, Honda, and Toyota. Volkswagen, one of the hardest-hit automakers, is now demanding that Europe inject cash into its chip-making business. Analysts also worry that popular Chinese electric vehicle makers will face issues as the nation imports most of its chips. While some companies like BYD have complete supply chains, it's not clear how NIO, XPeng, and Li Auto will fare as their own customer demand grows. Elsewhere in the market, manufacturers and consumer electronics are suffering. Microsoft continues to warn that Xbox Series 5 and Xbox Series 5 shortages will last until June. Sony has said that it's hard for it to increase PlayStation 5 production, and Advanced Micro Devices says console makers in general would struggle to satisfy demand until the fall. Although gamers were snapping up gadgets early on the pandemic, the winter holiday season saw Santa struggle to get consoles under Christmas trees. Other products at risk? According to semiconductor solution provider Himax Technologies, laptops, TVs, monitors, mobile phones, tablets, and digital cameras could all face shortages thanks to the chip crunch. All have already reported chip shortages consequences, and others could soon do the same. With a chip shortage, bottom line, there was only one big winner. While there are no doubt losers from the chip shortage, there are some big winners. Global semiconductor sales are also rising with demand, and the companies that can deliver will succeed. Looking at where things stand, that's why many analysts says that Taiwan Semiconductor is the winner. The company is the largest dedicated integrated circuit foundry, and analysts expect earnings to grow more than 18% this year. Additionally, Taiwan has asked TSMC to prioritize meeting auto chip demand. Adding new tools and building a factory is not that easy. Chip tools become the latest victim of global semiconductor crunch. Longer delivery times mean slower ramp-up of production capacity. The shortage of computer chips is also being felt by manufacturers of chip-making equipment. Wait times for drill machines used on printed circuit boards and substrates can run up to a year. To solve the global chip crunch, you will need more chip-making machines, but you won't be able to get them because of the shortage of chips. This conundrum is the latest sign of how the global semiconductor supply crunch is now spreading so far that it is rebounding onto the chip-making industry itself. Delivery times for some critical tools have grown to 12 months or more, which will slow capacity expansion plans for a wide range of suppliers, including chip manufacturers, packaging and testing service providers, and substrate suppliers. The global component shortage is already affecting some of the world's biggest buyers of chips, including Apple and Samsung Electronics. At least four types of vital production equipment are in short supply, according to industry sources. Some of these equipment makers are also suffering from chip shortages, and some are struggling with labor shortages due to pandemic lockdowns, like all other tech players, and that weighs on the process of building machines. COVID-19 lockdowns had disrupted production since last year, and just when it was about to recover, the serious chip and component shortages hit them. The lead time for wire bonding machines, mainly supplied by Singapore-based Kulik and Sofa, has grown to 10 to 12 months. Wire bonders are commonly used in the chip packaging process, the step after chips are fabricated on wafer materials. For wafer dicing machines, which are used to slice wafers into chips, the delivery time is as long as 5 to 8 months, thanks to the unprecedented demand, compared to 1 to 3 months in usual condition. Their supply is dominated by DISCO of Japan. Delivery times for chip-making machines made by Advantest of Japan and Teledyne of the United States, among others, have also grown significantly. For laser drilling machines used on printed circuit boards and chip substrates, leading equipment maker Mitsubishi Electric has warned other clients that the lead time for some tools is now more than 12 months for orders placed from now on. The lead time for high-end chip substrates has lengthened to 52 weeks. Travel restrictions imposed to fight COVID-19 are also hampering equipment delivery and installation, as personnel are usually dispatched to help clients install and test the machines. Some equipment suppliers have tried using virtual reality headsets and simulation software to remotely guide clients through the process, but some critical support must still be provided on-site. The White House on Monday held a virtual summit to address the chip shortage, with tech and other executives from the United States, Asia, and Europe in attendance. But with the chip crunch now impacting equipment suppliers, the shortage has created a chain reaction. Electronic and automakers expect component makers to expand capacity to address the shortage. But when these component makers talk to their equipment and material suppliers, they realize deliveries could be as late as the end of the year or even next year. That means basically everyone is kind of stuck here. The dangerous part is that even if only one or two components are lacking, the whole system would be unable to move forward. University of Minnesota banned from contributing to Linux kernel. All of the past contributions from students and faculty are also being removed. The University of Minnesota has been banned from contributing to the Linux kernel by one of its maintainers after researchers from the school apparently knowingly submitted code with security flaws. Earlier this year, two researchers from the university released a paper detailing how they submitted known security vulnerabilities to the Linux kernel in order to show how potentially malicious code could get through the approval process. Now, after another student from the university submitted code that reportedly does nothing, kernel maintainer and Linux Foundation fellow Greg Crower Hartman has released a statement calling for all kernel maintainers to reject any code submissions from anyone using the University of Minnesota EDU email address. In addition to not accepting any new code from the university, all of the code submitted in the past is being removed and re-reviewed. It seems like it will be a massive amount of work, but Hartman has made it clear that the developer community doesn't appreciate being experimented on, and that all of the code from the university has been called into question due to the research. The possibility of bugs slipping through is well known in the open source software community. The university has put out a statement saying it's been made aware of the research and is subsequent banned from contributing. It says it has suspended the line of research and will be investigating how the study was approved and carried out. In a statement meant to clarify the study, the researchers said they intended to bring attention to issues with the submission process, mainly the fact that bugs, including the ones that were potentially maliciously crafted, could slip through. Kernel developer Laura Abbott countered this in a blog post saying that the possibility of bugs slipping through is well known in the open source software community. In what appears to be a private message, the person who submitted the report non-functional code called Hartman's accusation that the code was known to be invalid, wild, and bordering on slander. It's unclear if that submission, which kicked off the current controversy, was actually part of a research project. The person who submitted it did so with their own EDU email address, while the patches submitted in the study were done through random Gmail addresses, and the submitter claimed that the faulty code was created by a tool. Hartman's response basically said that he found it unlikely that a tool had created the code, and given the research, he couldn't trust that the patch was made in good faith either way. There's been criticism from some in the open source community saying that Hartman's deciding to pull any patches submitted by the University of Minnesota is an overreaction, which could lead to bugs fixed by legitimate patches being reintroduced. It's worth noting, however, that the plan is to re-review the patches and to resubmit them if they are found to be valid. Now, to an outsider like me, it seems the researchers were trying to bring attention to the public that open source material is vulnerable and the kernel maintainer is not happy with the manner of attention that was used to bring it to the forefront. Instead of resolving the issue, it has evolved into an open dispute that only shakes the confidence of open source code, as there is no action pending to have peer review of all submissions. The MTA, that's the Metropolitan Transportation Agency of New York, pulls security cameras from the New York City subway trains due to vendors' ties to Chinese facial recognition company. The MTA on Thursday abruptly halted a program to test new security cameras on subway cars, a day after the Daily News raised questions about the ties the company providing the technology has to a Chinese firm that specializes in facial recognition technology. Transit managers last week sent a memo to subway crews alerting them of new video cameras installed on 4-car G-Line train, and the new tech is part of a years-long effort by the MTA to improve security and put more eyes on the ground. The test program installed 4 cameras in each of the cars, as well as a system that operated the train's digital signage and intercoms. The cameras began monitoring passengers on the G-Line train last Thursday, and MTA officials plan to keep them there for a year to see how they work. But the vendor, contracted to provide the system's technology, Suzhou Huawei Intelligent Technology, raised major security flags that prompted officials to suddenly pulled a camera-filled train from service on Thursday. The company in the first quarter of 2019 was acquired by Baibai Railway Transportation Technology, a Chinese company that has ties to the country's government and listed facial recognition technology among its specialties in its 2019 annual report. MTA officials said they signed a deal with Suzhou Huawei to test the cameras in January 2019 before the company's acquisition was finalized. The agreement to test the technology for a year came at no cost to the agency and did not require approval from its board. MTA spokesman said transit honchos were not aware of the test cameras until the news began asking questions about Bai Railway on Wednesday. This short-term test and evaluation was designed to determine whether the equipment would meet New York City Transit requirements to qualify as a potential approved system for future subway car procurements. Once leadership became aware of the test program and questions were raised about control of this particular company, they ended the evaluation. It's unclear whether the cameras ran on software that employed facial recognition technology, but MTA chairman said no facial recognition was used in any subway security cameras during a news conference. A federal government source could not immediately tell the news whether Suzhou Huawei or Bai Railway were subject to active inquiries by national security authorities, but the source noted that the MTA plans to potentially move forward with this pilot initiative stand a very good chance of sounding alarm bells with a national security agency. MTA officials have, over the last 2 years, expanded the number of security cameras installed in subway stations and platforms, and plan to have nearly the whole system monitored by the end of the year. The agency has no timeline to put cameras on every subway train, but transit officials said they require all future subway cars the agency purchases to come equipped with closed-circuit TV. The cameras in stations and platforms do not run on the same technology as the ones yanked from the G train. It's not the first time in recent years the MTA has ran afoul with the feds over its relationships with Chinese companies. Congress in 2019 passed a measure in a defense spending bill that prohibits transit agencies from receiving federal subsidies for rail car purchases from China Railway Rolling Stock Corporation, a company owned by the Chinese government. The company was a winner of the MTA's Genius Transit Challenge contest launched by Governor Cuomo back in 2017 and was awarded $330,000 for a proposal to design a lightweight, Wi-Fi-equipped subway train for New York and promised to invest $50 million of its own money in the project. The ban on the Chinese railway purchases does not go into effect until 2022, and the Chicago Transit Authority this week began testing a new series of subway trains purchased from that company. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell, IT Pro Series, Post-COVID Return to Office Part 3.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, technology, and the workplace. Now, I am taking a detour. I am drifting away from the technology a little bit. It's still the workplace, and I still want to cover some of the bits and pieces of the personable side of our return to work. This is the post-COVID outlook on work, I guess, is the best way to describe this. It's a six-part series. I've already talked about the business side decisions to be made. I've talked about staying home if you want to. This week we're going to talk about going back to the office and you want to. So, look, we shifted a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago, and we are looking right now at the return to work is right around the corner. Now, if you are returning to work, you're actually returning to what you've done for most of your career. This is going to be mostly easy for you. Not as easy as the people from last week, and the people who are staying home and they want to. They've not only basically moved from the office to home, but they've adapted. You're going to have some readjustment period. You're going to have some migration. You're going to find that you're going to go back to work and you want to, and there's a bunch of people who are not going to be there. They're either resisting, or it's a phased return, or something more than that. I want you to stay chill. I want you to just relax and be aware that this is just happening. Now, the companies that are forcing everyone back after a year, I'm going to say this up front, they may not have thought all of the things through. I'm going to say this a little bit more next week. I want you to be prepared to be back at home off and on. I want you to be prepared for the idea that we may be going through this return to work over the course of many months, and it could be a matter of, okay, a week here, a week there, stuff like that. However your company decides is how it's going to happen. I want you to understand that there are a lot of different approaches here. The thing that you're going to struggle with the most is that some people may still stay home. There are people who, okay, there was an executive recently. He said that everybody is sick of their family. Okay, I'm not even going to get into that today, but look. There are people who enjoy their family. You may not, or you may be all alone and you're anxious to get back to the office where you know people and you see people. But these are all new situations. There are work bargains. There's work status. There's all kinds of different things that you're not aware of. If somebody doesn't come into the office, if Joe around the corner does not come back into the office, I want you to be supportive of that. I want you to reach out to Joe, check in on him, help him out. And it may not be Joe, it may be Jane, it may be Susie, it may be whoever. It doesn't matter. I want you to be supportive of all of your coworkers. And because this is going to be a hard time. This is going to be a time where there are going to be people who basically are going to, even in your office, they're going to stay home and they don't want to. And that takes skill to deal with that when you're at the office and you want to. So, all right. Nearly 70% of workers want their coworkers vaccinated before returning. That's actually matching the amount of people who would take the vaccine at the time of this survey that I read. Okay, look. There are going to be people who don't want to return, even though 50% of the people are vaccinated or 80% of the people are vaccinated. They're waiting for the herd immunity. They're waiting for all of this to go away. There's all kinds of different struggles. On the work side, I want you to be aware that work has changed. There are going to be new concepts coming along. You're going to learn them. You're going to have to learn them. You're going to have to adapt better than you've ever adapted before. Technical infrastructure has changed too. And there are going to be new features in the office. I'm going to lay out one more issue that I want you to be watching for. Because this is kind of the struggle area. This is the one area where if you're going back and you want to, you may be blind to something that may have happened or may not have happened. And this is the warning area for you. If your IT department is no larger than before, this is a big warning sign that I'm going to see. The other people who, if they're staying home, if the company's staying home, their infrastructure has grown already. If people are going back and they don't want to, or they're staying home and they don't want to, they're going to be aware of these things. You're going to be blind if your IT department is not larger than before. And I'll say much larger than before. You need to be concerned about long-term longevity of the company. Only companies that didn't get a larger IT infrastructure where it's okay are the ones where nobody went home. We're talking Walmart and Sam's Club and places like that. Even still, many of them got a larger IT infrastructure. So this is going to be your warning sign. This is the big one for you. And I hope you don't see that. I hope you see that they spent a lot in IT and they're spending a lot in the social distancing and the cleaning and all of that. But that's another side of outside of what we're going to talk about. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Apple's recent spring 2021 announcements. I was intrigued with the new iPad Pro announcement. Apple unveiled its newest iPad Pro tablets, and they're equipped with the same Apple-designed M1 chip in the MacBook Air, MacBook Pro, Mac Mini, and the new iMac. The 11-inch model starts at about $800, and the 12.9-inch model starts at $1,100. On the Apple website, based on the tech specs of the new M1-powered iPad Pro, configured with 1 terabyte and 2 terabyte of storage, the iPad Pro models come with 16 gigabytes of RAM. You would come to the conclusion that when the iPad Pro is fully equipped, that is to say, Magic Keyboard, SIM card, GPS, and camera, it is an iPhone on steroid. If you could replace the iOS operating system with macOS, you have yourself a regular Mac computer unit. When fully equipped, it's no longer a tablet. The device further blurs a line between the company's tablet and desktop offerings. Since the processor in the Mac, iMac, iPad Pro are the same, I could see the iPad Pro platform with a smaller screen size augmenting the Mac and the iMac sometime in the future. And, of course, with a larger screen, it does replace it. The tech specifications on the Apple website are not detailed. If you can pardon the pun, I was trying to do an apples-to-apples comparison of the iPad Pro with the other Apple units. There is no information if the iPad Pro units are upgradable on memory and storage. What is the clock speed of the M1 processor chip? If it is different at different levels of iPad Pro offering, it's important to know the relative speed difference. It can be the same chip in architecture, but it can differ in clock speed. The big question is, will I be able to run current A14 Bionic iOS apps on the iPad Pro with the M1 architecture? The new M1 chip is based on A14 Bionic chip found on old iPhones and iPad Air. Unlike many rumors indicated, it's not the same chip. Apple traditionally doesn't disclose many details about its hardware, so it isn't always easy to analyze its innovation and draw conclusions about where things are going. I guess I'm focusing on technical specifications only. On the Apple website, adjectives such as Retina display, Retina flash, XDR, and 2x zoom out blurs any meaningful description. It's advertising at its best without saying anything of substance. But I guess this is the Apple new norm for product introduction. Buy it and find out what's in it. So, what else was announced by Apple? Apple introduced a completely redesigned iMac that also has the M1 chip, and it has a thin 24-inch screen, a 1080p FaceTime camera, and comes in 7 different colors. They also come with a new wireless keyboard that includes Touch ID for authentication. You can buy the new iMac in 1 of 4 colors at $1,300 and up, and in 7 colors and better specs starting at $1,500 and up. Apple also released their AirTag item trackers, which you can track in the Find My app for $29 or a 4-pack for $99. It's very similar to the Tile Tracker product, which easily attaches to your things and use the free cell phone app to find them. With the AirTag, you need an iPhone for the app, whereas the Tile Tracker is available for both iOS and Android cell phones. Apple announced a new Apple TV 4K, which comes equipped with the same A12 Bionic chip found on the iPhone XS, XS Max, and XR. It can now play HDR and high frame rate videos. It will start at $179 for 32 gigabytes of storage. Apple revealed a new Apple TV remote, which is made of aluminum and has a click pad on the top. There's also a Siri button on the side. Apple now has available new purple iPhone 12 and 12 mini. I guess there is so much you can integrate into the smartphone that is now evolving into fashion design for new product announcements. Intel's challenge, Windows running on reduced instruction computer set. Windows and Office running on Intel's x86 processors enjoyed its dominant position for more than 30 years. Today, ARM processors are presenting serious challenges to Intel. What influence that Microsoft and other companies could have on Intel's future? Microsoft's first Surface ran on an ARM version of Windows called Windows RT. It came out in October of 2012, but this initial attempt didn't work out. In December of 2016, Microsoft announced a new Surface that ran on a Qualcomm Snapdragon ARM processor, followed by updated ARM-based Surface Pro devices in 2019 and 2020. Why such persistence? Microsoft engineers who have intimate knowledge of the x86 architecture understood the DNA defects of Intel CPUs. Microsoft decided long ago that ARM had a structural advantage, a decision later buttressed by the increasingly desktop-like benchmarks results of Apple's own AXX processors. So far, consumer adoption of the Snapdragon Surface devices have been lukewarm, but that could change. Qualcomm just bought Nuvia, a firm started by ex-Apple engineers who are focused on the design of ARM-based CPU chips. In the not-too-distant future, Microsoft could wield competitive ARM-based Surface machines, where competitive has two meanings, not too far from the max performance and, as a result, a threat to x86 laptops from Dell, Lenovo, and so on. Not to be outdone, PC clone makers will move to ARM processors made by Qualcomm and others. Intel knows this very well. Over the last 5 years, the performance gap has been steadily diminishing. It is an unfounded myth that the gap between RISC and CISC, or between x86 and everyone else, is large. It's not large today. Furthermore, it's getting smaller. Intel soon will have no choice but to announce Intel's commitment to the ARM architecture. However, unlike in the good old x86 days, Intel won't have a monopoly on chips that run ARM, Windows, and Office by supporting ARM CPUs. Microsoft has removed the x86 advantage, thus forcing Intel to join the ARM ecosystem. Now that Wintel and the x86 inflated margins and sales volume is on its way to obsolescence, Intel is left with an obvious move. Make it up in volume. The highest quantities are to be found in smartphones, a market that Intel declined to bet on. However, for Intel to win any significant volume in the smartphone market, it will have to successfully update its manufacturing process to be competitive with Taiwan Semiconductor and others. It will also have to make price concessions to win accounts away from existing suppliers. Next, we have the PC and tablet markets with lower quantities, but not necessarily higher prices. Consider the chips in the latest iPhones and the newest Mac laptops. They closely related in performance and, most likely, cost. Intel's final challenge is a data center space. The high-end x86 Xeon chips used to command both good volumes and very high margins. But a look at the last quarter of 2020 shows data center product sales are down 16% and operating income down 40%. The downward trend is hard to explain given that work from home helped create the hottest cloud data centers market we've ever seen. The company passed when they had a chance to acquire Nuvia, while that company still concentrated on making chips for cloud servers. Before that, Intel watched as then-president and cloud computing expert Rene James leave the company in 2012 to form Ampere, self-proclaimed creators of the world's first cloud-native processor. The ARM-based Altra, even more embarrassing, a look at Ampere's leadership team shows it's almost exclusively composed of Intel alumni, totaling close to 200 years of experience at the Santa Clara company. One imagines that the group lost the ARM battle inside Intel and then took their skills and energy into the Ampere startup. At the January 2011 CES, Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer made it clear that his company would no longer exclusively rely on Intel for the processors in its devices. For Intel getting back into the ARM business, they sold the previous one to Marvell in 2006, seems like a straight shot. A bit of paperwork, some money, a team of engineers, and they're in business. Intel could very well decide to follow Microsoft's lead once again and make ARM processors for the new Windows plus Office combo, of course using ARM. Intel to spend $20 billion on two new chip factories in Arizona. Patrick Gelsinger, Intel's chief executive, vowed that Intel would become a major manufacturer of chips for other companies in addition to producing the processors that it had long designed and sold. Gelsinger, who took the top job in February, said that he planned to spend $20 billion on two new factories near existing facilities in Arizona. He also vowed that Intel would become a major manufacturer of chips for other companies, in addition to producing the processors that it has long designed and sold. Intel had stumbled on developing new production processes that improved chip performance by packing more tiny transistors on each piece of silicon. The lead in that costly miniaturization race has shifted to Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing and Samsung Electronics, whose so-called foundry services make chips for companies that include Apple, Amazon, NVIDIA, and Advanced Micro Devices. Some investors and analysts had pushed for Intel to spin off or discontinue manufacture in favor of external foundries, an approach taken by most other chip companies to increase profits. But a pandemic-fueled shortage of semiconductors for cars, appliances, and other products has underscored the vital role of chip factories in supporting many sectors of the economy. Officials in Europe have also floated proposals for new factories to reduce reliance on foreign-made chips. The Intel strategy recognizes that the world no longer wants to be dependent on the ring of fire that is right there next to China. TSMC previously announced plans for a new factory in Arizona, a project is valued at $12 billion and that is expected to receive federal subsidies. Samsung is seeking government incentives for a $17 billion expansion of its facilities in Austin, Texas. Intel said its new global foundry service would operate from the United States and Europe, with further factory additions expected to be announced in the next year. It already runs plants in Ireland and Israel. The industry needs more geographically balanced manufacturing capacity. While it is committing $20 billion up front, Intel hopes to negotiate with the administration and other governments to get incentives for its manufacturing expansion. Though it makes most products in-house, Intel has long used external foundries for some less advanced chips. Gelsinger said the company would expand that strategy to include some flagship microprocessors, the calculating engines used in most computers. That would include some chips for PCs and data centers in 2023. And give Intel more flexibility in meeting customer needs. But manufacturing will remain the core of Intel's strategy, despite its recent technical problems. Gelsinger said significant improvements were being made in its next production process, which was delayed last summer. Intel also will engage with IBM in a new partnership to develop new chip-making technologies. Intel plans are bound to meet skepticism. Besides recent problems with manufacturing technology, Intel has tried in the past to operate as a foundry for other companies with little success. But Intel has modified those plans in several ways. For one thing, it will for the first time be willing to license its technical crown jewels, the so-called x86 designs used in most of the world's computers. So customers can incorporate that computing capability in chips they design for Intel to make. So instead of sitting there to see what may develop, Intel is proactive in saying they are in the manufacturing business and they will continue to be in the manufacturing business. Presenting Marty Winston, All Hands on Tech, Stewed Salaries.
You may have seen the data a week or so ago. A sizable percentage of work-from-home millennials gained 40 pounds or so. Pretty soon now, as the new hybrid normal arrives, the companies they work for will expect them to work from the office again. Maybe not entirely, maybe not every day, but disappearing is off the table, which also means that there isn't much time to make the extra weight disappear, at least get a start on it. Not many places either. Even a few weeks after getting both shots of vaccine, a gym may still not be the place that a millennial will trust to be pathogen-free. No matter how unrealistic or realistic that hesitation may be, it will be a factor. For the lucky ones with a good sense of balance and purpose, better weather will provide opportunities for walking, or running, or biking, or rowing. For the unlucky ones, the stress of it all may manifest in an escalation in that weight gain. Oh, don't forget the challenge of finding clothes that fit. For a lot of you, well, a lot of our audience is not that young, and those millennials are a little more likely to be your kids than to be you, but that doesn't mean the workplace new hybrid normal won't also impact you. Everybody will face transitions. This is the PC Radio Show, and PC doesn't stand for proper clothing or physical conditioning. And while so many people have been anywhere but at the office, a lot about work has changed. So crank your minds ahead a few weeks and envision being back at the office. And in your mind, look around. One thing you'll see is a lot more notebooks than before. A lot of them still feeding big screens and traditional keyboards and mice. And a lot of us learned that to get an edge, it was smart to have a lot of windows open on those screens, a lot of applications running, a lot of browser tabs open, a lot of resources funneling through our minds and getting consolidated into that one mangy report that the boss has been nagging to see. And we all became, well, a lot of us became intensive multitaskers. But in the new hybrid normal workplace, not everyone will have a second screen, and sometimes all you'll have is just the notebook screen. Multitasking becomes terribly difficult when you want to work with a dozen windows at once, but you can't see more than three or four. But multitasking, think about this, has always been a way to cheat being late. Ideally, you're so well organized that you always track and gather and have on hand and on file every little snippet of any little tidbit of information that any boss might ever want to see. Great theory. Really great theory. Especially if your home address is in fantasy land. Okay, so multitasking just got a lot more difficult. What now? Here's an idea. Multiplexing. In electronic communications, multiplexing is about using a whole bunch of channels all at once so even narrow signal pipes can work together to deliver fat buckets of information. Multiplexing at the theater, remember those? Places where you could watch a movie on somebody else's chair with the most expensive popcorn you ever ate? Multiplexing there means one theater has a lot of screens, each in its own room, each showing its own movie. Multiplexing at work means, pay attention, you may find you like this idea. It means doing a piece of work once that you can keep using and reusing over and over again. The more the next one is like the last one, the more time you save. If a lot of your work involves word processing, making templates can be a big help because it can give you a format and headings and some repeated wording that you then don't have to create from scratch every time. Boilerplate. Whole phrases or sentences or paragraphs that you tend to use over and over can also save a ton of time. Word, if you're using Word, Word offers quick parts and auto text, which take, to use their descriptions, galleries of building blocks. You could also just make yourself a boilerplate document with everything you might want to copy and paste into what you're doing now or next or last. Those are word tricks. If a lot of your time is in Outlook, one of the biggest shortcuts there is to build a library of signatures from a few lines to almost a page in length. In other words, if there are replies that you repeatedly have to send, put the whole reply in the signature, so selecting that signature will all by itself provide the rest of the message or everything but, "Hey, Phil," you know, the thing at the top. And consider the quasi-boilerplate that's already out there. Do you deal with products? Spec sheets and sell sheets may already say a lot of what you want to say, and there's usually some way to copy and paste. The core idea is do it once and use it plenty. Back to Outlook for a second. Are you taking advantage of its folders? You can make your own set of folders, each about a different something. When an incoming message is on that topic, you can copy or move that message to that special folder. When it's time to pull some of the related info together, think about it. You already gathered it. Searching won't take nearly as long as it would if you had to go through everything in your inbox. For example, just checked. There are 1,480 unread messages out of 38,055 total messages in the inbox here, right now. There would have been more, but a crash in 2005 took out a lot of the earlier messages. Next time, the show runs on Cinco de Mayo, the day after Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. And ironically, that's when a fleet of robots gets introduced in Cleveland. They're MOVE robots, MOVE with a U to put UV in the middle, part of a MOVE Crew UVC disinfection service. Beam casting robots in Cleveland. You know you'll want to be here.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the Computer Club. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, May the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, May the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, May 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. And the Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, May the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. That's limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.